So we're going to hear about a couple of patients who actually got venetoclax, and we'll get a little into the granularity of how this actually plays out. But let's bring up another patient who received a BTK inhibitor. The first patient received acalabrutinib and is still on it, and this patient got ibrutinib. So what happened with this man? It looks like he got diagnosed initially, Amy, and he's 58. He got diagnosed 2001, so he's a young patient.
Yeah, and when he sent me his pictures, he reminded me it was his 19th year. He had just had his 19th anniversary, which is great. So he was diagnosed with a small lymphocytic lymphoma picture. He had bulky adenopathy, not a real high white count. And his prognostic testing showed a 13Q and 11Q. And so we talked about these FISH results, and those are really most accurate when they're standalone, when there's one abnormality. When there are multiple abnormalities, it's not as easy to sort this out, but certainly an 11Q deletion is never a good thing. But he does have mutated disease, which is good. So clearly he was observed for multiple years. He ended up getting a thrice weekly rituximab. That was an old John Byrd regimen that he didn't want. He really didn't want chemotherapy. So we tried to not give him chemo. Then he went on a clinical trial of FCR with an investigational BCL2 inhibitor, and he had a partial response, which of course the FCR should have really done a good job for him. And he doesn't really stay in remission for an extended period of time. But we continue checking his FISH studies, thinking that he's eventually going to come up with a 17P deletion, and he doesn't. So we are able to observe him for a while. And then in 2015, he needs treatment again, and he starts ibrutinib. And so when he started ibrutinib, he really had some significant issues with nausea and diarrhea. And this is really common. When this happens, I tell people to take it at night when their gut is shutting down. And sometimes that helps. But we worked him through it with ondansetron and just over-the-counter anti-diarrheals. And this really went on off and on for a couple years. And I think we've got long-term data now that shows that these issues do get better over time. Although it's really hard to say to a patient, oh, in 2 years, you'll really feel a lot better, you know, so it's a very hard thing. And then in the summer of 2016, just on routine CT scanning, he had a kidney mass and he had kidney cancer. He got a partial nephrectomy. He is a great case for the difference between BTK inhibitors and our venetoclax, where venetoclax really gets patients into a very deep remission. We talked about the need to hold these drugs, our BTK inhibitors, ibrutinib and acalabrutinib, for procedures because of bleeding risk. So he, of course, stopped for a week before and after that nephrectomy, and his white count really started marching back up again pretty quickly. So it was a great representation of really knowing that that CLL was just under the surface, and the second that drug stopped, he started having lymphocytosis again. And this is his curve of, he started out with a lymphocyte count somewhere around 40,000. His biggest issue was splenomegaly. And look at that, it went up into the 300,000 range. That was a really, that's probably one of the biggest jumps I've ever seen. And then you see it go down. And then that blip up again was when he stopped for a couple weeks for his nephrectomy. So these are things that you just have to have patients understand how the drug works and why these things happen.
It must have been interesting to explain to him why his white count went up to 300,000.
But you know what I did? He could see his nodes just melting. His nodes were just melting away. So that was, it was good. And he remains on ibrutinib, and he is really doing really remarkably well. He started it in March of 2015. He remains on ibrutinib, and he sent me a bunch of pictures, and he really, he's a guy who always worried. So when we saw him initially back in 2001, we didn't have all these new drugs, and his life expectancy was somewhere around 10 years. And he had that in the back of his mind. And he talked about in the email he sent me with all these pictures, how he really feels like ibrutinib gave him his life back. He does not think about dying every day. He doesn't worry about dying every day like he had until he started ibrutinib. He's a beekeeper. He and his father restore old tractors. He's got a dog. He fishes. Like, he's a really active, great guy who really has done remarkably well on ibrutinib.
So, yeah, Amy, you sent me the note that he sent along for this conference. Just a couple of kind of really interesting. You mentioned the fact that it was his 19th year and that the doctor initially told him that it was unlikely he would see his 50th birthday. Now he's 59. He says, after about a year on ibrutinib, interesting, he spells it wrong after being on it for 5 years.
He probably calls it the trade name,
which I don't even know what it is. But anyhow, about a year on ibrutinib, I no longer thought of dying or my disease or anything. Ibrutinib gave me a normal life. I am sometimes fatigued and have some muscle and joint pain, but this could be just the effects of aging. This drug has really given me back my life. There's still some stress in my life. And he talks about, as you mentioned, all the things he loves, gardening. It sounds like a very rich life. And
yes.
I'm just kind of curious what it's been like to see him go through this, Amy. You know, it's amazing when you stay in a field for years, you grow with patients. What's it been like to take care of him?
It's been up and down. He really had a lot of anxiety and depression initially. He really struggled emotionally with this diagnosis because, of course, he thought he was dying before he was 50. And it really has been remarkable, the change in him since starting ibrutinib and realizing, and now he knows that we have venetoclax and we have other drugs for him after the ibrutinib. It's been up and down with him. He's been divorced twice since we met him. But I mean, it's great. It's great. And he, you know, he's somebody, my kids are 15 and 17. And so I was pregnant when he was getting treatment. And you really do establish relationships with people. I'm friends with his mother on Facebook.
I'm curious, Brad, any comments? You know, you see more and more patients like this, which I guess, quote, in the old days, you never really saw people who did this well. What's it been like to see these people for years, Brad?
Well, that's the best part of the job, honestly. And people will often ask me, how can you do what you do? And of course, we have patients who don't do so well. You lose patients. It's a terrible feeling. It's very demoralizing. But you just keep going to work. You go to clinic. You see patients like him. And they're so grateful and you're so happy that they're living a good life. So in a way, the job's not that hard when you have some patients like that in your life. So I think it's the best job you can have.
Yeah, I mean, if you think about it, you know, there are a lot of challenges, but how many people in the outside world get to see something like this? It's really a miracle, somebody getting their life back. Let's move now on to how these decisions get made. We've kind of been focusing on the tools, particularly the new tools that are out there. And now the question is, how do you take those tools and begin to integrate and decide which one to use and when to use it? And that gets into what we call the strategy of oncology. And so we're going to talk about several clinical trials. We've alluded to those. We just really want to provide a macro view of how these trials were done and why it changed the way we take care of patients. So